Well, I think one thing we're going to do right out of the gate is define what pro-life is.
Scott Klusendorf talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That term is now being confused. It's being put up for grabs, and we're going to make clear what the pro-life syllogism is, how we can make that case for life with people who don't accept biblical authority, who maybe don't even know what it is we stand for, and are subject to being confused. So there's a crying need to clarify what pro-life means, what our actual arguments are, and then we'll look at five bad ways people argue against the pro-life case in the public square so that we can be prepared to give good, solid, Christ-honoring answers.
You can meet and hear Scott Klusendorf making the case for life at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Learn more about conference speakers and topics and register at issuesetc.org. If you're reading through the Old Testament, you have gotten through basically a chronological telling of the history. You get past 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles. Then you have Ezra and Nehemiah. They're the story of the return from exile. It kind of feels like you're entering a new section when Esther pops up. It's a little jarring to have a story that, well, the first thing you ask is, where does this fit in the chronology that we've been following so far? And then you say, why is this story here? It seems a little out of time, and you have to read the entire story before you actually get to a point. It's an amazing story. It's an intriguing story. It's full of literal intrigue, conspiracy on both sides. But we still have to ask the question, what is Esther doing there in the Old Testament? Many have noted, of course, that it does not mention God's name in the book. That might raise further questions. But it's there. Is it a just-so story about a rather obscure Old Testament feast? Is there something more to it? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Monday afternoon, the 21st of May. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to spend the first hour in our series introducing the books of the Bible today. Esther, Pastor Brian Wolfmiller will be our guest. Then in hour two, we will remember, as the church does on this day, Emperor Constantine and his mother, Helena. On the 21st of May, the church remembers them. Dr. Bill Weinrich, professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, will be our guest. Joining us to continue our series introducing the books of the Bible today, we turn to the book of Esther. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, he's pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado, co-host of a weekly radio talk show called Table Talk Radio. He's author of the book, Has American Christianity Failed?, and he's publisher of Everyone's Luther, Prefaces to the Books of the Bible. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you.
First, let's get to the question of where this fits in the chronology. We have been more or less chronological up to this point, all the way to the end of the book of Nehemiah. Then we are back in the exile? Is that where we are?
Yeah, we do. We jump backwards. There's two ways to ask the question. You know, when did the events happen and when was the book published? So the events of Esther happened back in the exile under Xerxes. Ahasuerus, or Ahasuerus is his Greek name. The story is happening back between the first and the second return. If we go back in history, we remember that there was the Zerubbabel's return that started rebuilding the temple, then Ezra returns, and then Nehemiah returns. So we're pushing back to that time between Zerubbabel and Ezra, and probably the dates are 483 to 475 or 474 BC is when Esther was queen over there in Persia. So we push back for that, although the best tradition, even though it seems like Mordecai himself, one of the main characters, wrote some notes that this book was published by Ezra, the priest and the prophet, who sees later, around the year 425 or so, that the messianic promises are coming to an end, that Zechariah and Malachi are going to be the last of the prophets. And so he is putting this together as the canon is closing up and as the Lord's people are going to get ready for 400 years of prophetic silence.
So does this answer the question of authorship on the book too?
I think it does. I mean, there's two conservative traditions on who wrote the book. One is Mordecai, who notes at the end that he wrote a bunch of letters that went out to all the people, to all the Jewish people, explaining this Feast of Purim, and that seems like one of the major purposes. And so Mordecai did write some of these things down, but there's other indications that this book was written down later, especially the very first verse, when the distinction is made between Ahasuerus, this particular Xerxes, and a later Ahasuerus, or a later Xerxes, who was to reign. And so that's going to push the dating of the writing of the book, the kind of conclusion of in the publishing of the book, back about 50 years to the year 425. Now, there are people who love to impugn this book, as there are people who love to impugn all of the Old Testament text. But it's interesting that Esther stands as the hardest to impugn because, you know, a lot of the critical scholars, you know, they bring an anti-miracle bias. They bring a kind of a naturalistic understanding of the world to the text. And so they say, because the prophets are speaking of all these miracles, these can't be true, and they're later stories and stuff. But what's interesting is that Esther doesn't have any of that stuff. I mean, it's noted that Esther doesn't mention God's name. It doesn't mention any particular miracles. Although, I mean, we might start to read and say, this is really too many coincidences to simply fall into place, and we see how the Lord is arranging these things. But the Lord is in the background here. So even though the liberal scholarship would want to impugn this book like they do all the rest, there's not many things that they have to grab onto.
So what's the purpose of this book? If you read through it and you're just kind of glancing, you think, okay, it explains this rather obscure Old Testament feast. Is there more to it than that?
Well, yeah, it that is the purpose. It seems when you read the book and just take it as a book, as a literary piece, the chief purpose is going to be to give rationale and, in fact, perhaps even divine sanction to this new Feast of Purim. I mean, as the people are back in Jerusalem and they're there with the rebuilt temple, they're going to go back to the books of Moses and they're going to see the feast that the Lord put in place there. And they're like, well, what is this Feast of Purim? Moses didn't give us this. Where did it come from? So Ezra wants the people to know where the thing came from. So that is its basic purpose. But the book fits into this overarching theme of the history that we've been studying, which is namely that the Lord keeps his promises and the Lord protects his people. While the purpose is to demonstrate the origin of the Feast of Purim, the theme of the book of Esther, which is even more important and more wonderful, is that the Lord protects the people from whom the Messiah will come. God gave to Abraham, remember, this threefold promise: your seed will bless the nations. And for the sake of the seed, he gave him the promise of all these people and this land. And so the Lord is going to keep the people, and he's going to keep the land. And he's doing that all for the sake of the promised seed, the Messiah to come. And this is another chapter in the whole story of the Lord preserving his people for the sake of Christ.
All for the sake of the promise. I mean, this is not ultimately about any kind of ethnicity or nationality. This is about God keeping that messianic promise.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, always it's for the sake of the promise. Always the central thing is the theology. And now that we've, in some ways, as we finish Esther, we've laid the history, and we'll go back into that history and hear the preaching of the prophets. We're going to see over and over that the Lord is going to be rebuking the people for misidentifying the object of the promise. The Lord always has his eye on Christ. The Lord always has his purpose in the cross and resurrection. That's always where it's pushing. And so when the people start to think that they're the end of the Lord's affection rather than the means to get to this Messiah, then the prophets are going to come and rail against it. It's when the people confuse confuse the sacrifices, and they think the sacrifices are an end in themselves and not pointing to the end, which is Christ. Or the land, they think that the land is an end in itself and not realizing that the end of the land is Christ. The end of the people is Christ. The end of the priesthood is Christ. The end of the kingdom of the kingship of David is Christ. All of these things end in Christ. And when they start to think that these are ends in themselves, then the Lord is going to send the prophets to rebuke that pride.
So one other question, and it has to do with the godless nature of this, that in that the deity is never explicitly mentioned in Esther. Should that be a problem?
No, I don't think so, especially when you read it. And if you just sit down and read it straight through, you can see how the Lord is working all of these things in the background. And I hope this doesn't sound impious. It shouldn't be. But you can see the Lord's fingerprints on all the things that are happening. You could see exactly how the Lord works. So we have five or six main characters in the story, and Haman is one of them. He's this guy who's second to the king Ahasuerus, and he's raised up, and he's this particularly prideful guy. And the Lord is going to go through all these ways to end up embarrassing Haman, and in the end, Haman becomes his own worst enemy. And it's exactly like Hannah preached when she sang in the temple, the Lord exalts the lowly and he casts down the prideful. And so when we see Mordecai's rise, we see Haman's fall, we see exactly how the Lord does things. So and it's funny. I mean, that's the book of Esther is an incredibly engaging story. All the twists and turns, they're amusing, especially as we know how the things work out. And so we see the Lord working to protect his people in completely surprising and unexpected ways, but it's what we've come to expect. We've studied the Bible and recognized that every turn of the page brings us the unexpected. Now we're starting to expect the Lord to act like this in these surprising ways. He doesn't come in and save you the way you think he should. He doesn't come and rescue you the way that you expect him to do it. He's always working things in a different way until we get to the cross, which is the least expected of all. But all of the unexpected turns in the book of Esther are really a proof for us who are reading the book that the Lord is orchestrating these things and not the people there. The people are become the tools that the Lord is using to bring about his will.
Two things that you wanted to note at the outset before we get into the actual narrative, and one of them is that there are a few cultural things we need to understand before for the story to make complete sense, and let's deal with the cultural one here quickly before the break, which is how you approach a ancient Eastern potentate. You can't just waltz into his office or make an appointment.
That's right. That's right. I mean, this is so helpful for us to understand prayer, because we don't have throne rooms. I think the closest thing we have is a court where the judge sits on a bench and he comes in and all rise and you have to be invited to approach the bench and everything. But even, you know, in the United States, we have the division of powers. And so the executive branch and legislative branch and judicial branch are all separate. In the ancient world, that was all combined in one place, and that place was the throne. So the king would make the law, execute the law, and adjudicate the law. We remember this especially when Solomon was hearing court cases. You know, the two ladies who one child died and the other was alive, and they bring them to Solomon to sort out the dispute. So the throne was where all of this legal stuff was happening. And the throne room, the inner throne room, was, to take holy language and use it, it was a holy place. You couldn't just, not everybody had access to it. There was rules around it. And we see that in the case of this Persian king, Ahasuerus, that it's illegal to walk into the throne room. When it's time for Esther to go, she's the queen, and she hasn't been invited into the throne room. And she says, there's a law, there's one law. And that is that if you go into this throne room and you're not invited, you're put to death. With the slight exception that every once in a while, the king would take his golden scepter and he'd point it at the person, and then they would be spared. Their life would be spared and they could come into the king. So you get this idea of this room, and here's the throne, and they call in the invited guests. But if you walk into that room, there's men standing by the door with swords ready to lop your head off unless they get the indication from the king that you're allowed to be there. Now just to take that across into our own understanding of prayer. We just waltz into the presence of God? No. I mean, if there's all these things to stand between the normal people or even the queen and the king, how much more is there before God? To go and stand before God, to have an audience before the throne of heaven, is something that you would dare not do unless you were invited. I mean, if Esther is afraid to stand before her husband, the king, how much more should we be afraid to stand before God? And if we weren't invited, I think this is how we would think about prayer, Todd. If we weren't invited to come into the throne room of God, we'd probably, each congregation would maybe have a voters meeting like once every 5 years, and we'd decide on one thing we want to ask the Lord, and we'd designate one person to go and pray and ask that one thing of the Lord, and they'd have to have the same attitude that Esther has. If I die, I die. I mean, this is the sort of fear and trembling with which we should approach the throne of God, except that he has now come and invited us to do it. He's invited us to stand before his throne. He's in fact commanded us to come and offer these petitions to him. And this is not something to be taken lightly. We should rejoice in this obligation and this gift that the Lord has given us in prayer.
Pastor Brian Wolf-Miller is our guest. We are in our series introducing the books of the Bible. Today we're introducing the book of Esther. When we come back, one more note here, and that has to do with... It has a little bit to do with idolatry, a theme that runs through these exile books like Daniel and others, when the Jews refuse to bow. Stay tuned.
Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $120 to Issues Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship, or you can make your $120 check payable to Issues Etc., write scholarship in the memo line, and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans in their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
Theology for Blue Collar, White Collar, and Clerical Collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Trinity Lutheran Church, LCMS, of Tryon, North Carolina, also serves the South Carolina Upstate. We uphold the confessional standard of the Evangelical Lutheran Church. We follow the apostolic practice of celebrating the Lord's Supper each Lord's Day using a biblical historic liturgy. Our small parish is teeming with little ones, along with many of retirement age. Several Issues Etc. listeners have been welcomed into Christ's fold here from outside Lutheranism. We invite any unchurched in the area to join us at 10:15 each Sunday.
Do you long for a church where the gospel of the sinner's free justification is front and center, and yet where a robust sacramental life is confessed and lived? Do you long for a church that rejoices in the sacred scriptures as the sole basis for the church's teaching and proclamation, yet values and listens to the witness of the ancient fathers and councils? Welcome to the Lutheran Church. We are what you've been looking for. Find a Christ-centered, cross-focused church near you on the Find the Church page at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's our series introducing the books of the Bible. We're introducing the book of Esther. Pastor Brian Wolf-Miller is our guest. He's pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado, co-host of the weekly radio talk show called Table Talk Radio, author of the book Has American Christianity Failed?, and he's publisher of Everyone's Luther Prefaces to the Books of the Bible. Our mutual friend, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, is author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Echo, Unbroken Truth Worth Repeating Again. This is a catechism of sorts. Actually, it is the catechism in a kind of obliquely told way. He comes at it from a different angle, yet still teaches the same ancient, unbroken truths that, as he says, are worth repeating. That's the catechism part, again and again. Find out more about the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Echo, from Pastor Jonathan Fisk at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for Echo, Unbroken Truth, Worth Repeating Again, by Pastor Jonathan Fisk. Pastor Wolf-Miller, there seems to be a problem with the Jews. They don't like bowing to, or they're very particular about the circumstances under which they bow. We find this in, I think, the book of Daniel as well, in several stories, and it's also here in Esther.
The boys were reading to me from the book of Daniel this morning on the way to school, and reading the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who refused to bow and worship the king there in Babylon, the Babylonian king, and they get thrown in the fiery furnace. It's amazing. And then Daniel, same thing happened. That's why Daniel ends up in the lion's den. And I've been studying lately the martyrs. I can't stop thinking about the martyrs. And the same thing happens to them, especially in the first 3 centuries of the church, these 12, 13 waves of persecution. And the soldiers come in and they say, just, you know, worship Caesar, offer a little pinch of incense, and it'll be fine. There, I was reading about this guy Romanus the other day, and all these Christians were giving their necks to the sword because the Bishop Romanus said, don't be afraid to die. Don't worship the Caesar. And they, the soldiers are so upset. Why? What's going on here? Who's behind this sedition? Why are these people so willingly dying for the faith? And they find Romanus and they give him all sorts of terrible indignities before they finally strangle him in prison. But it's the same sort of thing. They ask him, why are you willing to die for this? Well, this unwillingness to worship other gods, it becomes the mark of the believer in exile. And it's true with Daniel. It's true with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It's true with the Christians under the Roman rule. It's true later with the Protestants under even the Catholic persecutions, the Christians under Muslim persecution, that when the Christians are in exile, they refuse to bow down and worship. And the same thing happened. This guy, Haman, is exalted by the king, so he's second in charge, and everyone was to bow down and give him honor. And Mordecai, he's Jewish, and he refuses. He refuses to bow down. And that refusal to bow down and give homage, to give a divine honor to Haman, becomes the source of Haman's great wrath, and the whole plot unfolds from there. But it's amazing that Haman's plot to kill all of the Jews in all of the Persian Empire, scattered throughout this 150 provinces, all begins with Mordecai's refusal to bow down. I mean, that seems like where so much problem comes. And here's the point. It seems like such a small thing. I mean, Mordecai, just bow down. But Mordecai recognizes that to bow down to Haman would be to deny the Lord who bought him. The Christians realize that to offer just a little pinch of incense and say, Lord Caesar, would be to deny the Lord that bought them. Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego recognize that to bow down and worship would be to deny the Lord who has rescued and redeemed them. And so the Christian faith is always marked by a refusal to bow down and worship other gods. Absolute refusal to do it at any cost. If it costs our hands, our feet, our eyes, our beard, our life, our family, we refuse to bow down and worship. This is important for us to consider because I think that while the Christian always considers themselves in exile, we always know that our home is the new heaven and the new earth and not this world. We are entering into times where we are extreme exiles from our culture and from the world around us. And we need to remember that will require of us a refusal to bow and worship. Even the smallest indication of faith or love or trust in something other than our God and Lord Jesus Christ is the denying of the Lord who bought us. So we see Mordecai here, and he strengthens our faith. He strengthens our conviction. He strengthens our back, so that we know that the one that to whom we bow is God. The one whom we worship is Jesus Christ and none other.
To me, that's kind of the point of the story. I know that there's a lot of points that we can draw from Esther. And it does help also explain, you don't get a Jew not refusing to bow to any kind of standard unless there's God in the picture there. Unless there's a proper object of reverence in the picture. To refuse it to one is to, as you have said, hold it exclusively for the other, because the Jews certainly had no problem bowing in the presence of the true deity. They did it a lot.
Yep.
So that seems to be kind of the big point of this story, kind of like those stories from Daniel that you referenced there, where refusal to bow or refusal to acknowledge other gods.
We see the whole scriptures then as an unfolding of the first commandment. You shall have no other gods. And I suppose the preface to the first commandment where the Lord says, I am the Lord your God. So the Lord is always showing himself to be our God. And then it's for the people to show themselves to be the people of God. We know they ended up in exile because they were worshiping idols. And now they're in exile, and it seems like they're starting to learn the lesson, although a lot of other lessons are getting confused in the midst of it. I mean, the exile becomes the origin of the Pharisees and a kind of obnoxious legalism, which ends up being worse than the pagan idolatry that they had before. But at least they're learning something about what it means to worship the true God. And we see in Mordecai, we see in Daniel, we see in these faithful men of the exile, and women too, here in Esther, who says, if I die, I die. We see a faith in God and the beginning of keeping the first commandment.
So tell us the story of, Esther's a character in there. The book has her name, but it could well be the story of Mordecai as well. Tell us the story.
Yeah, it starts with they're in this Persian Empire, and here's this king, Ahasuerus, who rules over, from the Nile all the way in Egypt, all the way down over to basically to Afghanistan, this huge, huge nation. And Ahasuerus is the king who rules over all of this, and he has a feast, and they're drinking like they would do in the feast, although it mentions, oddly enough, that the drinking was not obligatory. It was, you had the option. But in the midst of the feast, the king calls for Vashti, the beautiful queen, and she refuses to come and show her beauty to all the princes who are gathered there. And so there's a controversy. What's going to happen? And Ahasuerus says, what should I do? And all the rulers, the wise men, the counselors, the people who pay attention to the times, they come to Ahasuerus and say, this is a bigger problem than you think, king, because if the queen refuses to come into the and obey the voice of the king, then what are all the wives of all of the other men going to do? This will bring disorder in the family and the home. So Vashti, the queen, is dethroned, and there's now going to be something of a beauty contest to see who's going to take her place. So they gather all of the beautiful young women so that Ahasuerus can see which one that he would like to make queen. And they have a year of preparation. It's really quite incredible. There's like 6 months of, they get anointed with frankincense, and then 6 months of other kind of anointings and perfumes. And after these women have been prepared for a year, they go in to visit the king at the night. They go back to another palace in the morning. And so the king is looking for a queen. And finally, Esther, who had had favor amongst all of the men who were helping these young women get ready to visit the king, she's favored, and so she goes in, and the king falls in love with Esther. It puts the crown on her head, and now Esther becomes the queen. Now, she hasn't shown to the king or anyone that she's a Jewish girl. That's kind of kept quiet, but now this Jewish woman, is exalted and becomes queen over this huge empire.
Well, let's take a break there, and when we come back, we'll pick up the story where the trouble ends, because that sounds like a really good story. Here is this young Jewess in, well, albeit kind of anonymously entering the emperor's palace and becoming queen. That's a story of elevation there. Well, there's another story of elevation. In fact, the theme of elevation, being lifted up, becomes pretty strong from this point on in the story of Esther. We'll talk with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller about that right after the break.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/LCMSU.
Children are a gift from God, a rich heritage, a precious trust. They are sinners, baptized saints, little brothers and sisters in Christ. It is this beautiful vision that shapes our daily work as parents and grandparents, teachers, pastors, mentors, and friends. And it's this vision you'll see shining through every article in this month's Lutheran Witness magazine, The Gift of Children. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness. Interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, Visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
A mobile Lutheran Bible study. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. Paul's Lutheran, Coleman, Alabama. Faith Lutheran, Waterloo, Iowa. Emmanuel Lutheran, Everett, Washington. Lake George Lutheran Chapel, Fremont, Indiana. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Snohomish, Washington. Faith Lutheran, Buford, South Carolina. Trinity Lutheran, Great Falls, Montana. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Westview, Pennsylvania. St. Paul Lutheran, International Falls, Minnesota. Redeemer Lutheran, Marshalltown, Iowa. Trinity and Grace Lutheran, Bear Creek, Wisconsin. St. Paul Lutheran, Sevierville, Tennessee. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Sherman, Illinois. And Zion Lutheran, Dexter, Iowa. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. The Issues Etc. 300.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We are introducing the Book of Esther. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller is our guest, publisher of Everyone's Luther Prefaces to the Books of the Bible. Let's pick up the story where we left off. It starts well. Esther is, although there's a little fly in the ointment that she is a Jewish woman and no one seems to be aware of that. That's going to play in later. She is elevated to the king's bedchamber, literally. She becomes the chief of all the princesses or the queen of the entire affair. Is that theme of elevation going to repeat itself here?
Yeah, a number of times. And the next guy is going to be Mordecai. Now, he's not elevated yet. Mordecai is the uncle of Esther, but basically he has adopted her as his daughter. Her parents were killed probably in the siege sometime. So Mordecai is looking after her, and he's always hanging around the gates. It seems like this is what Mordecai is doing. He spends his time at the city gate paying attention, and he discovers a plot. This is the end of chapter 2, a plot to kill the king. And so Mordecai informs Esther. Esther informs the king in Mordecai's name, and they go and check it out, and it turns out it was true. And so the two guys are put to death, and it's written down. Now, that it's written down is important because that's going to come back later. But nothing, you know, even though Mordecai just saved the life of the king, nothing yet has been benefited to him. In the meantime, the king comes along and exalts Haman, who's just a guy, and he becomes probably a prince or soldier or something. He becomes the king's right-hand man, and he's given a share in the king's sort of divine honor. So it's supposed to be that to indicate how exalted Haman is, that all the people are supposed to bow. We talked about this earlier. The one who refuses is Mordecai. And Haman gets so upset that Mordecai refuses to bow. Why are you refusing to bow? He says, because I'm a Jew. I have the first commandment. I have the books of Moses. I can't bow to you. And so Haman now comes up with a plot to kill all of the Jews. He goes and he says to the king, hey, there's these people spread throughout the land. They refuse to recognize your divine honor. Give me the money to have them killed everywhere. And so this is going to wipe them out. I mean, this is going to wipe out the entire Jewish population, not just there in Susa, but everywhere where the Persians rule. I mean, this would have been the end of the nations. This would have been the extinguishing of Abraham's seed. And the king there, Ahasuerus, gives his signet ring and gives permission for Haman to do this, to execute all the people. And now we're wondering what's going to happen, because here's Esther, the queen, but the king doesn't know she's Jewish. Here's Mordecai, who's become the problem. You would think that Mordecai is getting a lot of pressure just to bow down to him. Look, all of us are going to be killed because of your refusal to bow down. But Mordecai stands firm, and in fact, Mordecai sees a way to make an appeal to the king to save the people. And that's really where the guts of the thing are going to unfold in chapter 4.
So how does that happen? What is Mordecai's bright idea by which he's going to literally reverse the entire situation?
Well, what's interesting to me is that Mordecai, while we're reading this and we think, man, this does not look good for Mordecai. This does not look good for the Jewish people. Mordecai has a different opinion. He is confident that the Lord will rescue his people. He has a faith that's demonstrated there. And we see it because his plan A is Esther. Mordecai says, look, the Lord has put Esther there in the castle as the queen for this very purpose. So Mordecai calls Esther and says, hey, look, here's the situation. The laws are being written and the notes are going out on this particular day, on the middle of the last month of the year. All of the Jews are going to be killed. And don't think that you're going to escape just because you're in the king's palace. I mean, this is also for you. You're going to be killed as well. So why don't you go in and talk to the king and ask him to reverse this law? Well, that's where Esther gives us this great insight into how things go into the inner court of the king. She says, no one can just go in there. If you go in there, you get killed unless he, you know, points the golden scepter at you. And Mordecai says, he says, look, you also will be killed, but salvation for the Jews will come from another place. In other words, God will keep his promises. If we are involved in it or not, God will keep his promises. But then he says, but who knows whether you were exalted for such a time as this? It's really quite poetic and beautiful in a way. And Mordecai is able to recognize it and say, he doesn't speak like a prophet. You are here for this reason. He doesn't have that sort of certainty. But he has faith. And he says, look at Esther, it might be that all these blessings that the Lord has given you, your beauty, your intelligence, your appeal to the king, the conversation that you guys have, that it might have been that the Lord has done all of these things just for this reason, not for your benefit, but for the benefit of your neighbor, for the benefit of your countrymen, for the benefit of all of Abraham's seed. And so Esther says, all right, fine. I'll go talk to the king, even though he hasn't called for me. In 30 days, he hasn't called for me. I'll go talk to him. And if I die, I die. It's great. She's willing to die also for the sake of her countrymen. So she asks Mordecai to fast. She says she's going to fast. Her women and her household are going to fast for 3 days. And then she's going to go to the king. And she does. They fast 3 days later. She walks into the king and presents herself to the king. And this is the moment. What will the king do? Will he let her come in to hold out the golden scepter? Or will it be the end of Esther? And it turns out that the king lifts the golden scepter, points it to Esther, and Esther is welcomed into the king's sight. She goes and kisses the scepter, and the king says, ask me whatever you want. I'll give it to you, up to half of my kingdom.
Okay, so the first part of Mordecai's plan has been successful. What happens next?
Well, Esther is not just going to go to the king and say, could you not kill all the Jews? She's going to butter him up. So she says, king, my only request is that you would come to this banquet. You and Haman would come to this banquet that I've prepared for you. The king says, all right, let's do it. So they go into the banquet. It's Esther and Ahasuerus and Haman, and the three of them have this great feast. And in the middle of the feast, I mean, the king knows that this is a game that Esther's playing, that she's buttering him up to ask something quite spectacular. So the king says, well, Esther, what is it that you want? And she says, only one thing, and that's that you would come back to another feast tomorrow. So the king says, fine, I'll play along. I kind of like this game. So they leave the feast, and they're going to come back in the feast tomorrow. In the meantime, this is great. This is where it gets really good. In the meantime, Haman is walking home, and he walks past Mordecai, who refuses to bow down. And here's Haman, who thinks, here I am, number two to the king, the only one invited to the banquet that's held by the queen. I'm the richest and the greatest man next to the king in all of this thing. He has all of these things. But here's Mordecai, this Jew who refuses to bow down. So he gets home. And he tells his wife and the people around him, look at how great I am. The only thing that gets me every day is this Mordecai. And so his wife and the counselors of Haman say, build a gallows and let's murder the guy. And so he does. He orders this construction of this huge gallows so he can hang Mordecai on a stake and kill him in his backyard. Now, this is great, Todd. While Haman is there building the gallows in his backyard, the king is trying to go to sleep, and he can't go to sleep. And so he has someone come in and read the annals, you know, just kind of reading his own history. I suppose it's a journal that someone else kept for him. And so one of the servants is reading to the king some of the annals, and he reads the annal of how Mordecai saved his life. And he says, "Has anything been done to honor Mordecai?" And the people say, "No, nothing." So the next day, the king goes and Haman comes in to talk to the king, and the king says, "What should the king do to honor the man that the king wants to honor?" And Haman thinks that it's going to be him. I mean, Haman can only think of himself. This is his downfall. He thinks only of himself. And so he thinks that the king wants to give him some great honor. So he says, well, he should wear the royal robes, and he should be set on a horse, and he should be marched around town with someone saying, "This is what happens to the man to whom the king wants to honor." And so the king says, "That's a great idea. I want you to do that for Mordecai." So Haman now has to take Mordecai, the bane of his existence, the guy that he hates most of all, and put this robe on him and march him around town extolling him while he wanted to kill him. And so he goes to he kind of goes home at last with his head covered in this great shame, because the Lord has arranged it such a way that Haman has had to exalt his worst enemy. And it even gets better.
We'll take another break, and when we come back, we'll find out how. Pastor Brian Wolfmiller is our guest. It's our series, Introducing the Books of the Bible. Today, we're looking at the book of Esther. In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., we'll be remembering, along with the rest of the church, ancient Emperor Constantine and his mother, Helena, remembered by the church on the 21st. Dr. Bill Weinrich will be our guest. Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Jonathan Fisk is the author of our book of the month for May, Echo, Unbroken Truth Worth Repeating Again. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Echo by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. book of the month for May, Echo, Unbroken Truth Worth Repeating Again, by Pastor Jonathan Fisk.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
Christ-centered, cross-focused, you're listening to Issues Etc.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Would you like to learn about the Reformation theology you hear on Issues Etc.? We'll send you a pamphlet of Luther's Small Catechism for free. It contains the biblical teachings on the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and confession and absolution. Order your free copy of Luther's Small Catechism today. Just send your name and mailing address to talkback@issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our series, Introducing the Books of the Bible, we are introducing the book of Esther, an intriguing story with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller.
If you know a recent high school or college grad who isn't certain about a career or would like to spend some time serving the church before entering the workforce full-time, tell them about Lutheran Young Adult Corps. It provides opportunities for young adults to grow in a community of faith through full-time service in urban ministry settings. Participants can serve for 10 weeks in the summer or for 10 months as a gap year. Learn more at lcms.org/young-adult-corps. Lutheran Young Adult Corps, lcms.org/young-adult-corps. Brian, now we're coming to the best part here. Haman is all tied up in knots because up to this point he thinks he's riding his own ticket with the king, but it turns out that he's riding Mordecai's ticket. What happens next?
And then as he goes home, this is an important thing because we have two little indications to this thing that we're talking about, that the Lord keeps his promises. The first is when Mordecai said to Esther, if you don't do this, then the Lord will rescue us another way. And another little indication comes here at the end of chapter 6. So when Haman is leading Mordecai through the city, thus it is done to the man in whom the king delights to honor. And after this, he goes back to his house, mourning. He's got his head covered. And I'm now in verse 13. It says, Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that happened to him. His wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. So there's this indication that the Lord will protect and keep his people, and so it is. That prophecy there from Zeresh, the wife of Haman, is going to happen like this, because as soon as she speaks it, the eunuchs are there from the king's house to invite Haman back to Esther's second feast, and they go back to the feast. There's Esther, there's Ahasuerus, there's Haman, and the king says again to Esther, playing along, okay, Esther, whatever you want, I'll give it to you, up to half of the kingdom. What is it that you want? And Esther says, I just want you not to kill me. And the king says, what? What are you talking about? And so Esther says, I'm Jewish, and the law has gone out that all the Jewish people should be killed. And Ahasuerus is so upset, he says, who is the man who's done this? And Esther says, the adversary, the enemy is the wicked man Haman, and points to Haman. Now, Haman is terrified. The king is so angry, he walks out into the garden. The queen goes back into her chamber. Haman goes into the queen's chamber to beg for mercy. The king comes back in and sees Haman on the bed of the king and says, now, not only are you going to try to kill my wife, but now you're trying to take advantage of her and kill the man. And the king orders Haman to be killed, and he ends up being hung up on the gallows that he had built in his own backyard for Mordecai. Ugh, the plot couldn't have worked out more perfectly. And then in the meantime, Esther says, well, now it's not only is Haman the enemy, but the law is that all the Jews would be killed. And so the king comes, chapter 8, and says, no, change the law. Of course, they won't die. All the Jews should be safe. And in fact, the letters sent out by the king's emissaries that all the people who stood against the Jews are to be punished. And that's what happens in chapter 9. Mordecai is now exalted. He takes Haman's place as number 2 to the king. He sends letters out that says not only are the Jewish people not to be killed, but they're to be protected. And all of those who were plotting against them end up being put to death.
And how does that Feast of Purim, how does that fit into here?
Yeah, so on the day that they were supposed to die, instead they have a feast. And it's called Purim because this word pure apparently means dice or lot. And all that, for a year, Haman had been casting the lot to figure out how to destroy all of the Jews. And so now that this is turned on its head, instead of being killed, the Jewish people are feasting on that day. And that becomes a memorial now every year that they would gather together on this day, the 13th day of the last month, and the 14th and the 15th. And they feast and they rejoice that Haman was destroyed, that their lives were preserved by the Lord through the intercession of Queen Esther.
I got a couple kind of housekeeping questions. The king seems kind of blissfully unaware of his own orders. He gives an order, and then later he's like, who ordered that? This often kind of happens in these stories of exile. I've often wondered whether or not there's a bit of kind of poking of fun at these pagan kings. They don't often seem to know
be very smart about either what they've ordered or what ramifications their orders may have. It's a theme that also occurs in Daniel.
Yeah, there's just so much flattery going on that you wonder if that's what it is for the king, you know? I mean, you even see it when Esther's having these feasts. I mean, Esther just doesn't say, she doesn't appeal to the reason of the king. She appeals to the hubris of the king, to the delight of the king. These kings seem to like to drink wine. And so there's that, you know, if you can get a couple bottles in the king, you can change his mind. I don't know, though. I mean, the administrative burden that was placed on these kings is monstrous. It's hard for us to imagine it, I think. It's hard for me to imagine, anyways, the amount of power that these kings had, the amount of traffic that was coming through these throne rooms, the amount of decisions that they were making on a daily basis. I always am trying to fight against the sort of felt board picture, you know, that there's the king and there's like a couple of houses on top of a hill and that's Persia. I mean, it was millions and millions of people in it that he was ruling over. It's this vast empire. So maybe when the scriptures are focusing in on one particular part of it, it might seem a little bit embarrassing for the king, but perhaps it's just lost in the mix. In some ways, Todd, it reminds me about how, like, Josephus barely mentions John the Baptist. For us, John the Baptist is it, and Jesus gets even less of a mention in Josephus than John the Baptist does. When we read the Bible, it's focusing in on these things that we should be focusing in on. But as far as the history of the world goes, it's no big deal. It's not a big thing. And so for the king to say, oh yeah, kill the Jews, probably for the world, that's not a big thing. Although from us, looking to see how the Lord will keep his promise, that seems like quite a thing.
If you are a Jewish reader of this, this is a just-so story. I mean, you may consider it historical or not, but it's a just-so story explaining the origin of this feast. But a Christian reading this, can they make any sense of this book if they don't understand what you've mentioned here so often? And that is the promise of the coming Christ that is working through the story of Esther.
Well, you know, I've seen people try to make sense of it, and without Christ, if you don't understand, remember the vision that Revelation 12 gives us of the dragon waiting to devour the child that's being born. This is the Old Testament. The devil attacking the people of God because he wants to destroy the promise. He wants to destroy the child. That this attack of Haman is a demonic attempt to destroy Jesus. That's what's going on. And if you don't have that, what happens is the story just becomes like a fable, Aesop's fable. It has a moral element. You have to be willing to die for the sake of your people. You know, maybe there's some patriotism there or something, a moral lesson to love your neighbor. But it is that. We don't want to take that away from it. It does, you know, when we see Mordecai and we see Esther, it encourages us. It strengthens our own convictions. But it's much, much more than that. It's not only showing us how we are to have no other gods, it's also showing us how God has chosen to have us as his people and that he will do whatever it takes to keep the promise of the seed who would crush the head of the serpent. The Lord is going to keep that promise, and he's going to keep that promise for Esther, he's going to keep the promise for Mordecai, and he's going to keep the promise for you and me.
With about 30 seconds here, does it in a sense almost foreshadow the nativity stories of Jesus, where again the devil is plotting to snuff out the promise even as it's being kept through the machinations of wicked kings and palaces and things like that?
Yeah, we always wonder at the rage of Pharaoh trying to kill all the babies. What's going on? Or of Herod killing all the babies in Bethlehem. What could possibly inspire such rage? Or here trying to kill all the, what could inspire such rage? And that is the rage of the devil trying to prevent his own destruction and trying to prevent our salvation. But the Lord will not stop until he's done it, until he himself has tasted the rage of the devil on the cross, tasted the wrath of God on the cross, and done that all for our salvation.
Pastor Brian Wolfmiller is pastor of Hope Lutheran Church in Aurora, Colorado. He co-hosts the weekly radio talk show called Table Talk Radio. He's author of the book Has American Christianity Failed? He's also publisher of Everyone's Luther, Prefaces to the Books of the Bible. Brian, thank you very much for being our guest.
My pleasure.
Join us for the 6th annual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th, 15 miles east of St. Louis in Collinsville, Illinois. You can meet and hear Hank Hanegraaff, Scott Klusendorf, Hans Feeney, Jonathan Fisk, Angus Manoj, Craig Parton, and Will Whedon. Attendance is limited to 400. Registration is $120 and includes meals on Friday night and Saturday afternoon and evening. Child care is free for children ages 1 through 12, thanks to the Lutheran Church Extension Fund. You'll find a conference schedule, and you can register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2018 Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th, in Collinsville, Illinois. The church observes the person and work of Emperor Constantine and his mother Helena on May 21st, and we'll find out more about them in the next hour with Dr. Bill Weinrich of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The story stands here as a testimony that God will not allow his promise to be killed off. Now, if the Jewish people are killed off and if they're exterminated, the promise dies with them, but his promise continues. That's why the book is there. Promise of God will be kept and fulfilled in Jesus Christ. I'm Todd Wilkin, Hour 2 of Issues Etc. in 5 minutes.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
What makes Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois so special? Our new members talk about the family atmosphere, the welcoming people, and the outstanding music. But most importantly, you'll be confronted with your sin and comforted with the assurance that Jesus has removed that sin so that you can live each day as his baptized and forgiven child. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is at 612 North State Street in Freeburg, Illinois. Sunday worship is at 9 a.m., Sunday school and Bible classes at 10:20 a.m. Call 618-539-5664.
40 Years Greatly Blessed is this year's theme at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. We engage young adults in a Christ-centered environment and provide an alternative to secular public high schools. Please help us provide tuition assistance to more students by making a special 40th anniversary tax-deductible gift at melhs.org and click on the giving page. Or call me, Dr. Jay Krause, principal, at 618-656-656. 0043.
I'm talking with regular guest Dr. Ken Sherb about a new book by one of his former professors. Which one, Ken?
The late Dr. Kurt Marquardt, and the book is The Saving Truth, Doctrine for Laypeople.
You edited this book.
Yeah, the unpublished manuscript was among Marquardt's papers, and it is vintage Marquardt, lively, engaging, centering in the Christ who saves, with an apologetics chapter at the end.
You can find out more about Saving Truth, Doctrine for Laypeople at lutheracademy.com.